On a chilly gray fall day in the Rockies, this is Go West Young Podcast, your show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver, and first of all, a very happy birthday to us. This is the one-year anniversary of our first podcast episode. You know, like all new podcasters, I'm sure I would be embarrassed to go back and listen to episode one a year later, but whether you have been with us from the beginning or you've just found the pod, thank you for being here. Coming up on the show today, we are going to take a trip east to an interview I did at the Society of Environmental Journalists conference in Pittsburgh a couple weeks ago. It's a deep dive into what happens to our forests when predators disappear. If you've ever thought there are way too many deer out here in the West, well, imagine what it's like in a place without mountain lions to keep the population in check. We'll talk to University of Pittsburgh researcher Michelle Spicer about her work on forest health and biodiversity. Plus, how did the city of Denver get its name? It happened this week in Western history. But first, let's do the news. President Trump stepped up his attack on America's national monuments last Friday. During a meeting with Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, the president called up Utah Senator Orrin Hatch to say that he is moving ahead with Zinke's recommendation to shrink Bears Ears National Monument. The timing isn't entirely clear yet, but Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders did say that Trump was planning a trip to Utah in December. So why spill the beans a couple months in advance? Well, Matt Lee Ashley, a previous guest on the pod, pointed out that Utah is the only state with two senators on a committee investigating Russian interference in the 2016 elections. Both Hatch and Senator Mike Lee are on the Judiciary Committee. And just days before, that committee's Russia investigation fractured along party lines, with Democrats and Republicans saying they would each pursue their own avenues. And just hours after that call to Senator Hatch, of course, the news broke that Special Counsel Robert Mueller was about to make his first arrest in the Russia case. The Bears Ears news also provided a welcome distraction for Secretary Zinke, whose news cycles went from bad to worse with the revelation that a two-person company from his hometown of Whitefish, Montana, somehow picked up a $300 million contract to rebuild Puerto Rico's electrical grid. Zinke says he has nothing to do with it, but now the FBI is investigating that contract, and there is bipartisan agreement in Congress to look into it there as well. And Zinke is facing yet another ethics complaint, this time over his campaign selling an RV to a friend of his at basically half price. That buddy, a Montana politician named Ed Buttry, is also on the shortlist for an assistant secretary position at Interior. And like so many other possible appointees, the White House has yet to make a decision on Buttry. We are here with Michelle Spicer at the Society of Environmental Journalists Conference in Pittsburgh. Michelle is a doctoral candidate at the University of Pittsburgh, focusing on forest ecosystems. And we went on a fascinating tour today to the Allegheny National Forest. And one of the things, many of the things that you talked about here were fascinating to me as a Westerner, I think have implications for forest management, not just on the East Coast, but on the across the country as well, which is why I wanted to talk to you. Start us off, what is the focus of your research that you're working on right now?
Sure. So in general, my research is focused on the concept of forest succession, which is how the community of plants changes over time. And one of the kind of really important concepts of that is how the plants respond to different kind of alterations or how a forest regenerates. So what I've been working on recently is basically looking at how overabundant deer have kind of collapsed the understory plant diversity and what we can kind of do to try to bring back some of that diversity and, you know, what are the patterns of regeneration.
When you say overabundant, how overabundant?
So for historical levels, here in Pennsylvania, basically we can have deer levels anywhere between like 3 to 10 times as many as we normally would have. So upwards of even like 45 deer per square mile, which is very high.
And there are that many deer because there's nothing eating the deer? Is that the bottom line?
Exactly. So it's part of this big, what we call a trophic cascade, where basically back in the early 1900s, humans have totally extirpated all of the apex predators. So we used to have wolves and pumas here in Pennsylvania, and we obviously no longer do because in the early 1900s we hunted them. And because deer have no predators, their populations have increased a lot. Now the only predator that deer have is basically humans if we hunt them or if we hit them with our cars, unfortunately.
And basically there aren't enough people hunting that many deer to actually control the population.
Exactly. The other aspect of it is deer are really good at coexisting with humans. So in very fragmented landscapes, in neighborhoods, deer can basically find lots of things to eat. My parents see deer eating out of their bird feeder in the winter. So deer are very good at living with us.
So what does that, first of all, what does that have to do with overall forest health? Having that many deer, what does that do to the broader ecosystem?
It actually changes the broader ecosystem a lot. So one of the main focuses of the work that I've done and that my lab has done is looking at the kind of indirect effects of having overabundant deer. So not only do deer eat a lot of plants, but they're actually really specific about what they eat or somewhat specific about what they eat. So deer have certain preferences, just like I like mint chocolate chip ice cream best out of all flavors. Deer have some plants that they like more than others. And so what ends up happening over time is deer will preferentially select some plants to eat all of those plants. And then the plants they don't really like or plants that can come back after being browsed by deer basically create this really dense layer. We call it the recalcitrant understory layer. And what happens is when you have a really dense layer of just a few deer-resistant species of plants, nothing else can grow underneath them. So they're really hard to get rid of. And what we've seen is this pattern of all across the northeast deciduous region, we basically have understory plant communities that are not very diverse at all. So literally, sometimes forests can have 90% of their original plant diversity that disappears.
Wow. So it's like a salad bar, but only the pickled beets that no one eats are left?
Yes, exactly. That's what it is.
What does that mean in terms of then the rest of the forest? Out here on the East Coast, there's very little virgin or old growth forest. So you've got forests that were logged 100, 200 years ago. Does that make it harder or put the rest of the forests more at risk?
So I wouldn't say that it puts the forest more at risk, but one thing that having overabundant deer and having these kind of collapsed diversity forests, one of the implications of that is it's actually really hard to get that diversity back. So we've done some kind of cool deer exclosure experiments where we've set up fences so that deer cannot come in to certain areas of the forest and compared over long periods of time how the forest changes if we protect it from deer. And one of the major things we found is that plants come back real slow, up to a decade before you get an addition of one or two more species. So we're actually seeing that these long-lasting effects of having overabundant deer are kind of depressing the plant diversity for long periods of time. And in addition, we're kind of seeing, that a homogenization of what a forest looks like. So one of the ways that we kind of talk about it is like a park forest where you walk out and you see all these big tall trees and you see this kind of little blanket of ferns and there's nothing else in the middle. And so that's basically there's only a few species in the understory, which normally that's actually where we have the great majority of our plant species diversity is down in the understory. We only have a couple of species and then you have trees that are already adults and you have no new recruiting trees. You have very low diversity and that's really persistent for decades.
So I know you've looked at deciduous forests. Remind us real quick, difference between deciduous and coniferous forests that we have more of in the West.
So deciduous is basically that on an annual cycle here, we have trees that lose their leaves. So in comparison to a coniferous forest, so things that we have, you know, pines or spruces, things that are evergreen forests.
So then in terms of that biodiversity layer that is much more dense in terms of biodiversity at the bottom here in the temperate deciduous forests, I know you haven't studied coniferous forests specifically, but would you expect a similar level of overall biodiversity lower to the ground as opposed to high up in the canopy and the treetops?
Yeah. So one of the major comparisons that we've been looking at is between temperate deciduous forests and down in the tropics, where we do see this kind of vertical distribution of plants all the way up into the canopy, since we have these kind of special types of plants called epiphytes and lianas, which basically grow on top of other trees. But we actually don't have that much of that, even in the on the West Coast. So there are non-vascular epiphytes, so things like mosses or and a few species of vascular epiphytes, but we don't have a very high diversity of that. So I would still actually expect there to be a lot of diversity in the understory in these kind of herbs and flowering plants. You know, we have very diverse grass species here across the U.S. And so I would expect that a lot of the patterns are actually similar, even though we actually have a different overstory composition.
This summer especially, but all summers, we think a lot about wildfire risk. What are the implications of your research when it comes to wildfire risk, both in deciduous and coniferous forests across the country?
Yeah, so fire is actually an additional complication that it's definitely connected in there. So one of the other major differences in between forests from maybe 100 or 200 years ago and forests today is that we have had very strong fire suppression for several decades. And on one hand, that's great because, you know, we don't have these big fires. But on the other hand, we actually have a buildup of a lot of brush and understory that makes fires, when they do happen, much more intense. And they're actually bad for some of the plant species. So here in the eastern deciduous forest, one way that we have seen that you could get some of that diversity back is by having kind of low-level cool fires. And that's one of the reasons why we can actually see a few kind of fire-adapted species come back into the landscape. And the fire could actually take out some of that recalcitrant understory layer, you know, those thick layers of just a few species of ferns. But what we've seen is that there's some really strong interactions in between deer and fire and canopy gaps. And so you basically need a lot of different things going on. So just putting fire back on the landscape in the presence of overabundant deer is not really enough. You have to kind of do all these things at once.
And then somehow reintroduce predators, which there's plenty of out west. I just want to clarify. You say pumas in the west, we tend to refer to them as mountain lions. Same species.
Same species.
They're just not east anymore.
Right. So we've extirpated mountain lions or pumas here out in the east, but they are still in kind of the northern areas up in Canada and then in the west coast.
Is there an answer to then the deer overpopulation problem other than more hunting or introducing predators back in? I mean, is there a solution, or does your research not even get there yet? Is that the next step?
Well, I would just say there's not one single answer. So, you know, there's lots of ways that on a small scale you can kind of manage for some deer. But it's actually, we have some successful projects in kind of farther north in the Allegheny National Forest, where basically we do have pretty good control over some of the deer population. So if you increase the hunting tags, basically, if you have more hunters, we can actually control those deer populations to go down to more normal levels. The problem is that I think that's still not quite enough, because one of the additional kind of problems is that after decades of not having a kind of strong population of some of these rare species, now we don't have a population that has a good close by seed source. So how are you going to get those species back? So, I mean, you know, we're thinking about some things like maybe even reintroductions or assisted reproduction of some of these more rare species that are deer sensitive, that maybe we could help them out, kind of give them a boost, or even taking out some of those competitors, some of those kind of recalcitrant species. So removing them. I know we talked a little about management in the Allegheny National Forest. They do sometimes herbicide some of these large, tracts of just one or two species. So that's certainly another option to kind of kick back and try to give the native species that are rare a chance to come back.
We also talked today about some of the groups that are trying to reintroduce the American chestnut in the East Coast. Sounds pretty similar. What's next for this research? What's the next step after your PhD wraps up?
Oh, well, there's plenty of questions still open. I honestly think every question that I start answering, there's more and more questions to ask. So one of the kind of future directions and kind of an exciting part of my research in the upcoming couple years is actually looking at how both kind of this deer overabundance problem interacts with other land management techniques. So we have a really cool project that's just hopefully coming out soon about how salvage logging and these competitors and deer all interact at the same time when you have a big light gap. And so this is an opportunity that naturally you can see with a big light gap. You can have all sorts of species regenerate and new species come in and kind of give a chance for regeneration to happen. So we have a really cool experiment trying to test that out.
And the salvage logging fits into that because if the trees, the downed trees are left, they provide more of a habitat, and if they're gone, they don't? Is that the...
Sort of. So there's actually a big debate about how harmful or how good is salvage logging. So the idea is if you have a natural blowdown, so for example, a big tornado comes through, throws down a bunch of trees, normally the owner of that forest would lose all of that profit. And so salvage logging is, first of all, a way that you can basically sell off those trees that already fell down naturally and get some profit from it.
But you've got a pretty short window there while they're still commercially viable.
Right, of course. And so the other side of that is these big, huge trees falling over adds a lot of habitat heterogeneity. So you have these tip-up mounds where basically the root has come up when the tree falls down, and that can be even like a refugia for some plants, so an area where plants are protected from, for example, deer. And we have all these kind of... different types of habitats that you wouldn't have. You have a lot of coarse woody debris on the ground. So all of these things could lead to salvage logging potentially be a bad thing and kind of decrease diversity. But then on the other hand, it's actually also kind of adding an additional layer of disturbance. So on one hand, when you look at a salvage logged area, you actually have a higher amount of light. You have a lot more kind of carbon kind of tilling up because the machinery kind of tills up the ground. So it actually could be, a good thing for some species as well.
So stay tuned for the results there.
Exactly.
All right, Michelle Spicer, it's been a pleasure. Has doing this research made you more or less of a fan of venison?
Well, I'm vegetarian.
So
but,
no.
Well, I'm mostly vegetarian because I don't really like factory farm meat.
Oh.
But,
oh.
So I'm actually like totally pro-venison.
There you go. All right, thank you so much for taking the time, Michelle.
Thanks.
Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. It was 159 years ago this week that the first store opened in the tiny frontier town of Denver, Colorado. General William Larimer staked a square mile claim along the South Platte River at Cherry Creek, and he named it after the territorial governor of Kansas, James W. Denver. It was a move designed entirely to suck up to Governor Denver in hopes that it would become the seat of what was then Arapahoe County, Kansas. Little did General Larimer know, but by the time he named the site Denver City, Governor Denver had already resigned and he had no say over where the capital would go. But the name stuck. When the Rocky Mountain Gold Rush started a year later, Denver City became a supply hub, getting a stop on the region's first overland wagon route. And with the Civil War looming, Kansas became a state in 1861, and Colorado became its own territory. Denver City did become the capital of Arapahoe County, and in 1867, the territorial capital as well. That's when the city got all highfalutin and shortened its name to just plain Denver. The railroad arrived in 1870 and Denver became the center of the Western mining industry. And when Colorado became a state in 1876, Denver became the state capital. By 1890, Denver's population boomed to over 100,000, earning it the nickname the Queen City of the Plains. The naming of Denver, Colorado, all thanks to a mistaken attempt to curry political favor this week in 1858. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. If you like what you hear, please go leave us a review on iTunes. It helps new listeners find us. We've gotten some great email suggestions for future episodes that will be coming your way in the coming weeks. We always love to hear more. Podcast@westernpriorities.org is how to get a hold of us. And if you haven't checked out our blog lately, there are a couple of must-read pieces up there, including one by my colleague Greg Zimmerman that lays out the Zinke Doctrine. It's now crystal clear how the Interior Secretary sees our public lands. He is doing everything he can to make them harder for the public to use and easy for industry to abuse. You can read those at medium.com/westwise. You can also find them at westernpriorities.org. Thanks again to our guest, Michelle Spicer from the University of Pittsburgh, and also to the Society of Environmental Journalists for putting on an absolutely fascinating conference. I can't recommend it enough if you're thinking about going. I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.